Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 417. Sunday, December 26th, 2021. Boxing Day.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, everybody. Got another podcast for you. This one is with a familiar voice, Jim, your ad attacker of the Attack Ads podcast. You know, you've probably heard me say that often, every time I introduce him. You listen to the Attack Ads podcast, right? If not, you're missing out. Attackads.blogspot.com. All right, here's me talking to Jim.
Hello, hello.
Hey. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Just recovered from the Christmas Eve drive. And you, of course, are with your mom, so, you know, you're set.
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, I've got a sinus infection.
Oh. Well, that is unfortunate, yes.
Yeah. Kind of a rugged Christmas. But I've taken the drugs. I'm on the caffeine. It is time to persevere.
That's right. Meritocracy does not reward the sick.
Meritocracy is practiced in the United States in the early 21st century does not necessarily reward the hardworking either.
Well, it depends on what kind of job you work hard at.
It depends on what sort of preparation you had before your schooling.
Well, that's what determines what gets you into the jobs that reward you well for your hard work. Yes, indeed.
So we're actually cribbing from a book called The Meritocracy Trap. By whom?
By Daniel Markowitz.
All righty. I was just watching a interview with Daniel Markowitz on YouTube, and it was with two Dutch college students at the University of Amsterdam. Sitting in front of a very simplistic graphic, very poorly framed. And their questions were so much better than the Ezra Klein conversation that we both listened to. You know, surprise, surprise. Dutch college students were focused on the meaningful content in Markowitz's message, whereas Ezra Klein is just being charming and charismatic and approaching things from, you know, his particular point of view, which is defense of the meritocracy.
Well, okay. I can see that. I listened to the Klein interview also. And I wasn't quite sure where he was coming from. I mean, he's really focused on making himself sound good.
Yes. Yes. I mean, that's why I say his primary features are his charisma and his social adroitness. Hmm.
Yes. He did ask a few good questions that Markowitz actually said, yes, that's a good question, and proceeded to answer. But on the whole, it's like, I don't know. I just got this weird empty feeling from listening to the interview.
Yeah. Well, as you can tell, I'm not a big Ezra Klein fan.
I'm not familiar with the guy, so I was willing to give him a break. But yeah, he seems to have lived up to your expectation.
So I am trying to get out of Zoom here so that I can read something that I just sent to you like half an hour ago.
I just read it. Yes.
It was a portion of somebody's review where they summarized the book. And let me ask you first, before I read it, is it a fair summary, do you think?
It is a crude summary. Markowitz goes into his book into the nuances that this summary erases.
Okay. Well, let's start with the crudity.
Okay.
And then you can provide some nuance.
Okay.
All righty. So again, the book we're talking about is The Meritocracy Trap. I have not read it. I have done my usual, you know, listen to the author for a couple of hours and assume that he's, you know, the points that he's hitting repeatedly are his main points. What's the full title of the book?
It is The Meritocracy Trap: How America's Foundational Myth Feeds Inequality, Dismantles the Middle Class, and Devours the Elite.
And how do you spell Markowitz?
Markowitz. M-A-R-K-O-V-I-T-S.
Alrighty. No Z's or Z's in that name.
No Z's, no.
Alrighty. So from somebody who, from the rest of the review, which I didn't screenshot and send to you, but somebody who is just antagonistic toward leftists in general, wrote the following summation of Markowitz's argument. The book can be summarized quickly. One, aristocrats do not work. They do not value education. You know, I think here might be a good time to insert a clip that you suggested.
Ah.
Do you work, Mr. Worcester?
Not work, as in honest toil, you mean?
Yes.
Hewing the wood and drawing the old wet stuff and so forth.
Quite.
Well, I've known a few people who worked. I absolutely swear by it, some of them.
It's very funny.
It is. The whole series is wonderful, I must say.
I would like to listen to it. Alrighty. So one, aristocrats do not work. They do not value education. Two, meritocrats work excessively hard and value education to advance themselves. Three, meritocrats were supposed to make the playing field more equal for everyone to get ahead, but instead they have become the new aristocrats. As they worked harder and harder with longer and longer hours, they forced others out. Four, as meritocrats achieved more and more knowledge, skills were unnecessary, trades disappeared. Five, as meritocrats gained access into better and better schools, their children became legacies. Six, as meritocrats earned more and more money, the divide between those at the top and those at the bottom widened, making it impossible for those at the bottom to rise because of financial requirements. Seven, aristocrats were very rich and influential. Now, meritocrats are super rich and powerful. Eight, meritocrats have created a meritocracy which has morphed into an aristocracy. Nine, the author states that only a nuclear debacle can now make the world a more equal place. Alternatively, he advocates higher taxes, more open enrollment, and fewer restrictions on college admissions so that everyone has an equal opportunity, which disregards one's ability to make use of such an education. He supports a host of other social programs, all of which to be paid for by the rich for the advantage of those in need. Soon, there will be one class, no rich and no poor, no uneducated, none without healthcare, etc. In short, a utopia will be born with the principles of socialism or communism. We will all be equal. For how long will this be true before another aristocracy arises?
Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah. So anyway, the summarizer here certainly gives away his own position with that very long number nine.
I was going to say, every time somebody writes for a long time with one paragraph and no paragraph breaks, they're getting upset.
Yes. Now, if you came of age writing on paper, you know, 8.5 by 11 sheets of paper, or if you came of age typing emails, you can go 3, 4, 5 sentences and it doesn't look like a long paragraph. But when you squeeze it onto a phone screen, it looks just like a wall of text and it seems agitated and, you know, kind of nutty. So,
right. It does depend on the formatting.
Right. But just general rule of thumb, to avoid looking like a lunatic, hit that enter key and then hit it again.
Yes. It is the textual equivalent of breathing.
Exactly.
Of inserting a breath, of not going, blah, 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 blah. You know, and finally collapsing because of no oxygen. Yes.
Yeah. And I've been that guy.
We all have.
All right. So there it is in crude nine pillars.
Yes.
What nuance is missing?
Okay. Well, points 1 through 8 can almost all be answered. And now this is, of course, from the frame of Markowitz's book. They can all be answered with, is that correct or is it not? Yes and no. So in every single one of his points, he kind of erases the nuance that Markowitz attempts to point out. For example, I guess number one is probably the most defendable as is written in a summation. The aristocrats do not work. They do not value education. Well, in the older aristocracy, they didn't have to work. They went to school, of course, because they did value education, but it was a specific kind of education that was not what we in the 21st century Western world consider necessary education. They had to learn how to get along with other aristocrats. They had to learn perhaps a profession or a trade if they were not to inherit the entire pile of money. So they may have to learn law or be a medicine or political science, which was at that time used to train the aristocrats who would go into the foreign service and maybe going to parliament. So the education that they value is very different from the education that we value, how to read, write, do the arithmetic and show up to work on time.
Right.
Okay. So that's number one.
And the elites learned French and Latin and
exactly.
History.
Yeah. Yes, exactly right. The aristocrat, the finer points of living well. So the Bertie Wooster, by the way, that was Bertie Wooster that you guys heard talking about whether he works, talking to a fictional character named Lady Glossop. That's from the television series Jeeves and Wooster with Hugh Laurie and Stephen Fry. And I wrote to you in the email, the show is so good that if you pick up one of Peachy Wodehouse's Jeeves and Wooster books and you've seen the entire show, the books read like a rerun.
Right, like a transcript of the show you've already watched.
Like it, not just a transcript, but it's almost as if they are cribbing from the show. Those guys were hardcore Wodehouse fanatics. And Stephen Fry actually wrote to Wodehouse and corresponded with him briefly before he died. So they were hardcore fans and they did a wonderful job on the show. Okay, so that's point one. Two, merocrats work excessively hard and value education to advance themselves. Okay, that actually is a fair point. Kind of misses nuance, but let's move on. Number three, meritocrats were supposed to make the playing field more equal for everyone to get ahead, but instead they become the new aristocrats. Yes and no. They have become kind of where aristocrats used to go, but again, they work hard, again, as opposed to aristocrats. And meritocracy was supposed to make the playing field more equal by getting different people into the aristocratic training program so they could become the new upper crust. But when it was suggested, they were not suggesting to pay the meritocrats, these new middle class origin, elite trained, educated people that would work. They were not proposing to train for them to work their balls off or to make a shitload of money. They were actually going to like better society. That was the James Bryant Conant at Harvard. That was his idea. He also quotes Brewster Kingsfield, I believe it is. I could look it up. He's at Yale. He got on with that program early. These guys were not there to make the new aristocrats. They were there to make the aristocrats less important by introducing common people to the high-end conduit of education. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Number four, as meritocrats achieved more and more knowledge, skills were unnecessary, trades disappeared. Hang on, back up. Trades, as in trade guilds, did kind of disappear because two things happened. The people in charge, who have always hated the trades because they allowed workers to charge more for their labor, they railed against unions and wanted to make unions disappear. Technology was what came in to make the trades disappear. If you could make a machine to build something very well that a craftsman used to build, you didn't need the craftsman. The meritocrats stepped in with their knowledge and were there to run and build the new machines. So that's a really simplistic. Number four is a very simplistic thing that I think, I mean, I'm glad it wasn't several paragraphs long, but that's another story. Okay.
Right.
Now, number five is closer to the truth as well. As meritocrats gained access into better and better schools, their children became legacies. Well, hang on. The schools themselves started to value well-educated children as opposed to well-connected children, well-born children. It used to be said, you know, you were either born in the manor house or you worked for the manor house. Well, now you have to pass the test to get into the college that trains the children from the manor house. Now, what happened in Markowitz's book is that as more and more people realized that this was happening, they trained their children better. And who better to get that training than people who have a shit ton of money to invest in their children, which has created an entire industry of school prep, extra education, test prep, tutoring, and it has exploded. At one point, Markowitz in the book asked the rhetorical question, let's say you wanted to pay for the education for your children in advance. You wanted to set aside a chunk of money. This is assuming you had it, of course. You wanted to set it aside in an endowment, and you wanted that money to go to the education. By the time your kid gets out of school, the money would be depleted. Question, how much would it take? $10 million for the absolute best education that people are actually buying. And that just shocked me.
So that's not just the tuition or, you know, the price of living while you're at school. That includes the preparation, which is, you know, starts at kindergarten, basically.
Exactly. And for some, I don't know if you would actually get any value out of it. They have preparations in utero. The whole Mozart babies. Look it right up. Seriously. It's like, whoa. And there is so much of that, and people have invested so much reputational capital in this working that it's considered an anathema if you can't get it. So your children start to apply for their kindergarten before they're born.
Right.
Because there's so much competition to get into that kindergarten and that preschool and that everything else. And my wife works in this division now, in early childhood education, where you're not only supposed to change the diapers, you're supposed to teach them something. And that is good if you teach them well, but if you try to drill stuff into them, they just get confused and cry and shit. So, yes, the cost of education as an advance into life has massively changed for everybody. Okay, let's go down to number 6. As the merocrats earned more and more money, the divide between those at the top and those at the bottom widened, making it impossible for those at the bottom to rise because of financial requirements. Absolutely. It's exactly what I just said. But, and here's the but, yes, as Pee-wee said, everyone I know has a big but. The divide between the bottom and the top is dwarfed by the divide between the kind of up and the extremely top.
Yeah.
He has a great chart in his book where he takes the rising inequality, the Gini coefficient of everyone, from the richest to the very poorest. And it, of course, does as you would expect it. It rises over time. Then, just for fun, he takes the Gini coefficient between the people at it's one of the quintiles. Everyone's divided into a 5 parts. He takes the division between the people at the 4th quintile and the 1st quintile. And there is a division. There is a rise, just like the general one, but it kind of matches the overall rise. But then he divides it again into centiles, I believe. He takes the 9th centile and the 10th centile. And the 10th centile has gotten so vastly more wealthy than the 9th that it's not even funny. They've actually crossed. Because at one point we had a income system that was enforced by exorbitant taxation, according to those who had to pay those taxes. Like 80% of your top income would have gone to income tax. Well, over time, we have totally shifted the tax structure, thanks to Lewis Powell and his memo, thanks to the Carlyle Group, thanks to a bunch of very rich people who have pushed themselves into Congress and have restructured the tax system starting in 1979. Not Reagan, not 80, Carter, 79. That's when they reversed the capital gains tax and the income tax preference rates. That was 1979. It got worse later under Reagan, but these people were very influential to go in there and change the taxes so that the very, very wealthy can get much, much, much more wealthy. Okay. So that's what number six is missing. It is impossible for the bottom to rise because of financial requirements, but the people who are stuck just below the stratosphere have to work harder and harder just to maintain their position. Okay. Number seven, aristocrats were very rich and influential. Now meritocrats are super rich and powerful. I don't believe that's the case. I believe there still are aristocrats. They never went away. They're just not as obvious.
Right.
Don't meet them. They are so powerful. They're so influential. The common person doesn't even know their name. And these are the people that are making the meritocrats work harder and harder. Sure, they're giving them a lot of money to do so, but the harder the meritocrats work, the less meritocrats, the super rich, the aristocrats, have to hire. It's simple negotiation. So to say that meritocrats have created a meritocracy, which has morphed into an aristocracy, misses the missing aristocratic element. The aristocrats have used meritocracy to take the teeth out of the system that criticized them. The aristocrats used to make all their money by owning land and owning factories and owning things that make them rich. And they used to mingle amongst themselves and very little outside of that. Well, then Marx came along and said that capital was bad and labor was good. So what they did was that they made a system, or they took an evolving system, and they caused people to become workers. Meritocrats work. Their labor is paid for, but they are extremely well paid. That is a contradiction of Marx. Aristocrats have flipped Marx on his head so that the argument doesn't apply anymore. And that was really the focus of Markowitz's book, showing that meritocrats are workers. They're not middle-class workers. Those people are losing jobs. Those people are losing steam in life. Those people are delving into depths of despair. No, but the meritocrats are working their balls off just to keep ahead. The aristocrats, who are very seldom addressed and very seldom looked at, they still exist. That's what this guy with this summation is missing. Number nine, I have only read half the book, so I don't know what the conclusions are, and I can't comment on those.
Fair enough. So you've touched upon, without making explicit, something that Ezra Klein actually got right, which is that there are two similar sounding but really diametrically opposed critiques of meritocracy. One is an aspirational critique, which basically buys into the basic premise of aristocracy, saying, yes, the people who work the hardest, who are the smartest, who are the most diligent, they should receive more. But the system that we have now isn't really a meritocracy. You know, it is drawing the best from the people who had the most advantaged start, but most people are just locked out entirely. Mm-hmm. But what Markowitz is making is a principled critique of meritocracy. He's saying that meritocracy, no matter how perfectly implemented, has certain downsides, which are just, you know, we really wouldn't choose to live with them if we understood what they are.
Right.
So what are those downsides of the perfect meritocracy?
Well, the perfect meritocracy critique ignores the work, ignores what work the meritocrats are working at. Meritocrats are lawyers, they are doctors, They are researchers, and of course, they work in the technology industry, because the technology industry is that's the growing industry, right?
Yeah.
That is where the money is going, because we want to find the next device that will make a lot of money. And that's the key. The devices that they're investing in are not devices that will help humanity. They're devices that will better capture a slice of the economy and perhaps even direct vast funds away from the old way of doing things to the new, now under development way of doing it. I mean, look back in history. Steam engines were the way to go for locomotive travel, because a locomotive is so powerful that you can't engage a clutch. That's why steam engines were there. You just put steam into the pistons and the engine goes faster and faster. When you take the steam out of the pistons, you can redirect that pressure elsewhere. You can vent it, do whatever you need. Then General Electric developed the traction motor, which was a big fucking electric motor, and paired it to a big generator. And that was enough of a clutch, enough of a disconnect between the internal combustion engine, which can't stop running, and the wheels, which must stop running. And overnight, steam locomotives disappeared. There were steam locomotives still on the assembly line, which were obsolete before they were finished. That's how dramatic the shift to diesel electric traction motors was. Okay. And I say that because I like to point out that none of this is new. When small computers started driving printers, typewriters very quickly became obsolete. There was a quality curve on printers, as everyone knows. I mean, you're not going to submit for publication to a nice publication house anything printed on a dot matrix printer, right?
No.
But once the printers became good enough to look like they were typed, typewriters went to the attic, went to the cellar, disappeared. And that spawned the rise of Bill Gates, the rise of Apple, the rise of the small computer. Those guys made their money by taking money that used to go to the IBM Selectric and other, you know, Smith Corona and all those people. Those people lost. That economy shifted drastically. Now, of course, you have the creation of home telephones, which has been robbed by the cell phone. You have all these other industries that are getting their lunch eaten by new technology, which is rising and changing people's habits and spending priorities. All of the things that are making money are not necessarily better for society. The biggest example has to be high frequency trading.
Yeah.
Essentially, you invest a crap load of money in fiber optic cables, a crap load of money in quants that can program like a bitch, and a crap load of money in mainframes. You analyze the market and you see where you can make purchases in a split second and sell them in two split seconds, which will make a tiny, tiny fraction of a profit that will grow to $1 million a foot of fiber optic cable. That's what the banks are claiming, that every foot of fiber optic latency is $1 million. That means they are stealing the investments of others by getting in there between the seller and the buyer that would otherwise only be the ones trading. That is not bettering society at all. It is stealing.
And there's such a simple solution to that.
India actually came up with that solution. They have a one penny tax on trades.
Yep.
And they do not have high frequency trading. Boom.
Yeah. Don't have to outlaw it. You just say, no. Hey, if you want to trade 20 times a second, no problem. We just need 20 cents from you.
That's right. 20 trades a second will cost you 20 cents, but I'm only making 18 cents. Oh, yeah.
So yeah, no. that is related to something that I just heard Markowitz say to these two Dutch kids on the video I was watching. He says one of the problems with meritocracy, just even in the abstract, is that we don't really have any definition for merit.
Yes.
Merit just, I mean, in a capitalist economy, merit just means whatever people will pay you for. So
exactly. Go ahead.
And in our current economy, it's very clear that jobs and job roles are not valued in any sort of rational fashion. Like he gives the example of a trash collector. Mm-hmm. A trash collector, you know, for every 10, he was talking in pounds, but we'll make it dollars. For every $10 worth of value or utility that the trash collector in his, you know, in performing his job that he lends to society, he gets $1.
Right.
Whereas the hedge fund manager or the high frequency trader, you could argue that they're not creating any value at all for society, but, you know, to the extent that they are reaping many multiples of what it is that they're providing.
Exactly.
So they are extracting value.
Yes. You
know, in the gross, you know, or I guess in the net, the net calculation is, regardless of, you know, what they claim to be providing to society, they are clearly extracting value. Where is merit in all of this?
Exactly. They have shifted the priorities of the economy. And furthermore, they have exerted political influence in lobbying, in campaign donations, in all manner of, I mean, the list of political machinations that we have in our country today is so long that several books have been written about it. And I've read one or two of them. One of the books, this is not Markowitz, this is somebody else, actually defined oligarch in a way that's helpful. An oligarch is somebody who has enough money that they can influence the political process in ways that make them more money or that stop their losses. Either way. So finally, everyone talks about oligarchs, but there's a definition right there. You have to have X amount of dollars to contact your representative or your senator. That senator or that representative have to be powerful enough to do what you wish after you've paid them. So there's an actual, there's a basement. You have to get past the second floor in order to influence the top floors, right? The more money you have, the more influence you have. Merit has become what those people work at.
Right.
Merit has not become the ditch digger. People will say that guy's lazy for working 12 hours a day with a shovel and digging a ditch. He should just be able to run a backhoe. I'm sorry, you need a backhoe. A, that's capital. You need training in backhoe. That's education. You need fuel. That's, I don't know, an externality of running the backhoe. If somebody can't afford all that, they have a shovel and they're called lazy.
Yeah. Now, it does make sense to me to say that the person with the backhoe is creating more value. But it's obscene to say that the person who doesn't have the means to do that and is instead digging with a shovel is lazy. That's just nuts.
Exactly. Yes. And that's why the whole merit argument is specious. It ignores those people who are not allowed into the jobs and career positions that are considered meritocratic, that are considered, these people got this job because they leaped through the hoops and hurdles of education and impressed the bosses and did the elevator speech and blah, 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 blah. And they therefore shall be rewarded. It absolutely ignores everybody who's raising food, taking out trash and building buildings.
Yes. Now, if you raise any of these points to somebody who is in favor of oligarchy or, you know, basically just right wingers in general, many of whom are working class or even poor, but who have imbibed the Kool-Aid of the Christian work ethic. You know, the first thing they're going to trot out is that, yeah, aristocrats traditionally didn't work and the wealthy now work harder than anybody else. Therefore, they deserve their level of wealth. But, you know, it's physically impossible to work a million times harder than somebody who's just putting in, you know, the minimum effort required to do their job at Walmart. Mm-hmm. You might be working five times harder. You might have, you know, mustered five times the self-discipline and the effort and the chutzpah to really get in there and do what needs to be done, but not a million times. There's just no way that the wealth enjoyed by the people making the most can be reduced down to the just deserts of their efforts.
Yes, absolutely. And Markowitz harps on this and makes the point that those people, like you say, who are, they love work, they love the work effort, and that's fine. I have no problem with that. They are, because they emphasize, oh, he works 12 hours a day, blah, 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 and look at his nice house. Yeah, but you can't get that job with your education. And right. that there's a reason for that. They don't want you in that job because you haven't gone through the hoops and hurdles and become part of the in crowd and gotten that job. The and that was what I talked about earlier, where the aristocrats changed meritocracy as a screen to protect their wealth. It's very difficult to argue against hard work.
Yep.
And the fact is that people are missing that the work that some people are doing is really just there to keep them on their toes. I mean, it is true, and he harps on this in a way that I find actually quite disturbing. The training that you get in these schools will make it easier for you to do high-level work better. I mean, let's face it, you and I possibly are smart enough to defend somebody at trial, but neither of us have had the training to become a lawyer.
Right.
We could never pass the bar without a lot of study. And I know you almost made a PhD in philosophy, so you're way ahead of the game as from me. I've actually read some law books, but that was a requirement for getting my captain's license. You actually have to read the regulations that are printed for the books, and so they teach you how to do that. I've also worked in law firms, so I've actually done a little bit of legal research, but I see how much more I would have to do just to pass the bar. That's the new credentialism is what the people that defend the hard work are missing.
So I would like to transition to praising the science fiction author Nancy Kress, but are there points of Markowitz's that we should get on the table before we divert from his book into a more general conversation?
Yes. One of the arguments he made that other writers like the guy who, Sandel, mm-hmm. that we talked about,
yep.
Markowitz points out that this system is so bad for everyone. Everyone is going to lose at this. Nobody really talks about how hard the kids have to work to make it. So he points out that Palo Alto, there are two really high-end high schools, Palo Alto High and Henry M. Gunn High. And these are factories for turning out elite college graduates that attend elite colleges. Okay. The problem is the pressure there is crushing. And the suicide rate is, their 10-year suicide rate is 4 to 5 times the national average. Well, because some of these suicides just go very quickly to the Caltrain track and throw themselves in front of the train. One student said, and the train whistle blows every 20 minutes or so. One student said, and I need to quote this because it's so powerful. When they hear the whistle, it's, quote, like the cannon that goes off in the Hunger Games every time a kid dies.
Wow.
This pressure to graduate doesn't go to everybody. It's not like everybody at Pali and Gunn goes on to Stanford. It's only a fraction, but it's more than the national average. So these are the best high schools. This is just another of the legs of competitive bullshit. Another student, this is for fifth grade. This is before high school. One teacher has something called the bonus question. The bonus question has to be answered before the end of the day, but she does not allow, or he does not allow, any of the students time to work on the bonus question. And the point is to teach them how to multitask, to teach them how to stop going to recess and just playing, or to stop going to lunch and just eating, and to work on problems. It is to teach them how not to be children, because when you get into the meritocratic work world, that pace doesn't let up. He quotes Jeff Bezos. I'm sure you've probably heard this quote from Jeff Bezos because he used to work there. The quote was, some people think you can work smart, hard, or smart, long, or hard. But at Amazon, you can't pick just two.
Yep.
And I say, wait a minute. He's like, you can't even reward the meritocrats for the success of getting into the job. That those jobs become crushing. My brother worked, he's worked at Microsoft. He's worked at Amazon. He's now working at Google. And he describes Microsoft as, and I hope I get this right, a male dominated gladiator contest. Or I can't remember his exact phrasing. It was quite beautiful. Management is gladiatorial at Microsoft. At Amazon, it's even worse. And the guy who was interviewing him for Google said, yeah, Amazon likes to fire people. We like to hire them.
So that that brings up the up or out promotion policies of many high-achieving companies, or the companies that hire these high-achieving meritocrats.
Yes.
Which, you know, is, I suppose, it's a cure for the Peter principle. The Peter principle is that everybody will get promoted until they land in a job that they're incompetent at, and then their promotions end. So everybody eventually settles into a position where they're incompetent. The cure for that is, if you don't get promoted, you get fired. But man, what a world. Who wants to live in that world?
Exactly. I mean, just because you're fired doesn't mean your mortgage goes away.
Exactly.
Doesn't mean your kids aren't hungry. Doesn't mean the car doesn't need either electricity or gas. Yeah, it's stupid.
Anything else?
Well, I will say that the book is very, very well supported. The book has, I think, 490 pages. Only 290 of those are actual text for the book. The rest are some pretty well done charts. And then they go into the end notes, which are done. I've never seen a font this small. I had to use both my reading glasses and my grandfather's magnifying glass to and that's why I'm only halfway through.
But you've read all of the text, right?
I have read all of the text up to page 149 out of 290. Yes.
Okay.
But yeah, I was impressed by by the effort that went into supporting his argument. I mean, he says early in the book, he is a product of the meritocracy. You know, he came out of a Texas high school, he went to Yale and about 10 other places, and now he's a professor at Yale Law. So, okay, this guy has to work hard. He therefore has to fill the end notes with some really small print just to prove he worked.
Oh, poor trees.
Oh, darn. Well, no, not poor trees. Poor eyes. I mean, it would be a 600-page book if the font had been decent.
true. I was just thinking trees dying to, create paper pages that nobody would read.
Right. At least these are impossible to read. So there you go. Yes. So there are fewer trees that died. More eyes will be spared because nobody can read it.
Nancy Kress, a science fiction author. She wrote a trilogy of books. The middle book is head and shoulders above the other two. The middle book is called Beggars and Choosers.
Okay.
And I think a fair number of people listening to this have read it, because I was going to do a Sea Realm book club on that book, and that was going to be the next selection. And then I just never got around to doing the next edition of the book club. But in it, there's a stratification of society, which is genetic. So there's three classes of people. Actually, there's four classes. Actually, there's five classes. But in general, the three classes are the livers. These are the people who just live. Above them are the donkeys. Donkeys are genetically engineered to be more beautiful and way smarter than the livers. They're kind of like, Tolkien's elves to the livers. They're just better in every way. They're just better. And then above the donkeys are the sleepless. And the sleepless are people who are genetically engineered to not only be smart and hardworking and all that good stuff, but they don't need to sleep. So there are very few sleepless. And above the sleepless, there are the super sleepless, who are even better than them. And there are very few of them. There's a substantial number of donkeys. And anybody who's doing any sort of productive work other than just basic technical maintenance. So the techs are people who are just a little bit above the livers, but not quite donkeys. They've been given some education and a little bit of genetic help, so they can service the machines. But the society is mostly automated. The livers, who are the bulk of the population, they don't work, they don't go to school, they don't have to do anything to provide for themselves. You know, there are public cafeterias, they're issued free clothing, you know, they have free housing, trains, you know, run free transportation. They don't have to do anything, but they feel entitled to everything that they're getting because the donkey politicians that provide all of these services, you know, the livers vote for them. Mm. You know, so to the livers, they deserve what they get because they vote. You know, that's the effort they put in. The livers are, you know, stupid, lazy, boring. They haven't, you know, they don't read books. The entertainment they take in is lowest common denominator. You know, they're super into sports. And the donkeys work really, really hard, you know? Yeah. And particularly the donkey politicians, they are despised by the livers. But the livers consider themselves, and the donkeys, you know, they encourage this conceit. The livers consider themselves aristocrats because they don't work.
Oh. You know?
And they despise work. And then, you know, things get interesting when there is a plague that doesn't affect people, it affects machines. It destroys the superconducting materials that are the basis for all technology in this society. So technology starts breaking down, the machinery of society can no longer provide for people, and people have to do something. Ah. You know? So that's where it gets interesting. And then the solution to that crisis is very fantastic. I mean, it's not worth considering in terms of being you know, analogous to our own situation, but this is a book from the 90s. And I think Kress was just really, really observant and I'd say prescient, but I think, you know, everything that she was describing was certainly, it was already ongoing in our society in the 1990s, but things have just progressed so much since then that her book looks prophetic.
Right? Well, I will have to read that. I have to say, though, that because she threw in the genetic alteration, that's the only part. It's like, it's kind of like when Star Wars went to the midichlorians.
Well, Star Wars was always a fantasy, and sure, the midichlorians tried to introduce a science fiction element to it, which just wasn't necessary. I mean, Star Wars is Joseph Campbell in space.
Yes.
The hero's journey. It's archetypal. We don't need any explanations as to how stuff works.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And but it just, everyone, midichlorians, really? You mean not everybody can do this? Come on. That was the killer.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah, I have to be born with midichlorians to beat Darth Vader. Shit.
But the, you know, technology increasing some human beings' cognitive abilities and ability to generate value and, you know, a return on their investment, that creating differential effects in society, that's real. Right. Yes. Now, that's already real. And it's going to become more pronounced over time. So for me, the genetic alteration of the more productive classes of society is what makes Nancy Kress's book science fiction.
Yes.
But it's not, to me, it's not anywhere close to the introduction of midichlorians into Star Wars, which just tried to change the genre in mid-story, basically.
I will say, though, I mean, you open with Nancy Kress, I'll give you a better one. How about Kurt Vonnegut?
Are you thinking, what's his name? There's a short story, something...
God bless you, Mr. Rosewater.
Oh, no, it's just the name of the character.
No, that's not what I'm thinking. It's okay. One of his bigger books, actually.
This is a short story, and there's a society where to make everybody equal, they're deliberately handicapping the people who are born with certain advantages. So beautiful people have to wear ugly masks. Strong people have to wear chains. Smart people have earpieces, which, you know, assault them with clanging, distracting noises every few minutes or every few seconds, depending on how smart they are and how often they have to have their concentration disrupted so that they don't, or, you know, they don't enjoy any benefit from their cognitive superiority.
I probably have read that one. I'm sure it's in one of the collections. No, the book I'm thinking of is Player Piano. Now, not many people have read this one, probably because it's so thick, but Player Piano was supposed to be called Utopia 59. Because it was written in 1959. And in that society, if you didn't go to college, you had to work at a really dumb job. So
you had two choices between working at dumb jobs. You could be an entrepreneur, you could cut hair, you could flip burgers, you could do, you know, farming. But there was a competition to automate everything. So somebody actually built, a barber built a machine that cuts hair. So he sold the patent off, and now he was going to retire very wealthy. But in the process, he was putting all the other barbers out of work. And it focuses on a highborn, well, actually a high achieving meritocrat named Paul Proteus, who graduated college and got the credentials and became one of the upper management. And it goes through all of the stupid rituals that they had as meritocrats that had nothing to do with the people who are working at the base. Now, if you didn't have your own business, you had two choices: the army, so you could march a lot and maybe go to war and die, or what they call, I think it was called the Reeks and Wrecks. And I apologize, I haven't read it in 30 years, but the Reeks and Wrecks were essentially a press gang of people that fixed public infrastructure. And it was almost as bad as being on a chain gang fixing roads. But the only difference was you weren't incarcerated. And this book was written in 1959. And I'm just amazed that more people haven't made the connection to Vonnegut when meritocracy is discussed.
Well, I like Vonnegut. I've read a lot of Vonnegut. I haven't read that book.
I know. I was a completist, right? So the only one I haven't read is God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, which is really hard to find. But that is also quoted in another book. But anyway.
The short story I'm talking about is Harrison Bergeron. And I just found a PDF of it. Here's the opening paragraph. The year was 2081, and everybody was finally equal. They weren't only equal before God and the law, they were equal in every which way. Nobody was smarter than anybody else. Nobody was better looking than anybody else. Nobody was stronger or quicker than anybody else. All this equality was due to the 211th, 212th, and 213th amendments to the Constitution and to the unceasing vigilance of the agents of the United States Handicapper General. So everybody has been handicapped down to the lowest common denominator in all ways.
And wow, it's like the Rush song, Trees, you know. and the trees are all kept equal by hatchet, axe, and saw.
Yes. So what's the solution?
What is the solution? Well, yes. I haven't read Markowitz's book, but I think the start, let's start. Let's just spitball stuff. Okay. Everybody needs to be paid by the hour. And you really have to start paying time and a half for overtime. And there have to be caps on how much you can work. If you can have one job that can get there at 7 a.m, get off at 1, you know, sleep in the corner and do this 7 days a week, but still earn $1 million, that's not fair. Something's wrong. Even before then, I've been thinking about this one for a long time. I think there should be a tax on businesses that don't hire enough people. There has to be a way of penalizing the business, not necessarily the individuals, but at least the business that transfers what was work onto technology. And another good one would be a tax on technology, similar to what John Michael Greer talked about in his Lakes trilogy or his Lakes series, where technology would be taxed at a much higher rate because it displaces labor. That isn't to say that it isn't useful, but we can't just build a gigaw and a doodad to replace every job. Those are a couple of ideas. I don't know. What do you got?
Well, I don't have one of my own. I was going to share one from Curtis Yarvin. You know who Curtis Yarvin is?
Yes. Okay. Mendacious Moldbug?
Yes. Mencius Moldbug.
Mencius Mendacious. Okay.
So this is the part of a subscriber-only essay, which is behind the paywall. I mean, this part of the essay is out in front. So, you know, this is for public consumption. And if you're enticed by this, then you can subscribe to his Substack and get what's behind the paywall. I am not subscribed to his Substack. The title is Retiring the University. To a substantial extent, America is the university. A nation is its government, and America's government is its university system. Sorry if this comes as news to you. America, but without the university system, is almost a meaningless concept, like Napoleonic France without Napoleon. Whatever the meaning of the next regime, it must be something else. If Napoleon is in France, Napoleon is in charge. If Napoleon is in charge, it's Napoleonic France. If it has the American university system or just the university, it cannot be the next regime. It must be the old regime. The survival of the meta institution is incompatible with the concept of regime change, because America's government is the university, and the world's government, of course, is America. The university is everything. Obviously, this is an exaggeration. The university is not everything. There is the media, which is not part of the university, but might as well be. There are nonprofits, which are not part of the university, but might as well be. There is the government, which is not part of the university, but trusts it completely. There are corporations, which are not part of the university, but outsource their technical training to it and trust it completely. And there are various hobbits who bring food and stuff. In the regime change, everything changes. It is not about the government. All of these, except the hobbits, who are humble and true and kind, and the corporations, which are at best soulless, are possessed. Nothing possessed can simply remain. The issue is not actually demons. You'll do fine, though, if you think of it as demons. Retiring the university leaves a hole in the heart of America. This hole cannot remain vacant. The university will grow back, or something worse will grow in. A successful regime change should follow the DDR model, named after the late great East Germany. To remove an institution by force, take three steps. First, dissolve it. Second, divert its sources of energy. Third, if its function is necessary, replace it. Imagine really getting rid of some noxious weed. It's not like plucking a flower. You want to get the flower, the leaves, the roots, and the seeds. Then you want to get rid of the soil and replace it with sand. Then you want to plant a cactus in the sand.
Wow.
And all this must be done in an orderly way without harming any human being, not even the professors. Force is not violence. As any parent knows or should, force is the opposite of violence. Force is not violence! Exclamation point. The ideal way to destroy any institution, to shatter it irrevocably into atoms, is to break it so artfully, so carefully, so tenderly that the atoms themselves feel better off being free. While this ideal cannot be achieved for all retiring personnel, it is often surprisingly possible, and always a necessary yardstick to measure against. Or do you think it's a bad thing, dear reader, that shattering? Or do you think it's in the right direction, but maybe goes too far? Imagine if the American right somehow, someday, erred by going too far. Neighbor, I'm laughing so hard I can't even type. Dissolving the university. Because the university is the heart of the old regime, it is absolutely essential to the success of any regime change that all accredited universities be both physically and economically liquidated, with a minimum of exceptions. The only exceptions being technically specified facilities like a medical school that may take time to relocate. Anything that isn't a pure trade school must cease to exist, body and soul. Dissolving the university, which of course means dissolving all campuses in this single meta-institution, is easy. What happens to any campus in the course of dissolution? And that's where you have to pay to read what's next. But
okay,
he's pulling no punches there. Not only do you have, you can't reform the university system, you have to destroy it. You have to tear down the buildings. You have to obliterate any evidence of its previous existence. It can't, you know, because in our modern age, a business, it can survive the loss of its physical plant. You know, it can survive the loss of its gathering place for its executives. You have to destroy it in every aspect, in every manifestation.
And I'm imagining that he picked the university system because nobody can get a meritocratic job if they haven't gone to a university. But well, I have to
more than that. He's a big critic of the culture. So, you know, the SJW culture, which started in the universities and now has exported itself to the New York Times and to Silicon Valley boardrooms and such, and, you know, basically into every one of our pockets because they enforce rules of behavior. And, you know, if you don't obey, you will be kicked off their platforms. That starts in the university.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right.
He calls the university system, the mass media, you know, the system of public intellectuals, all of this together, he calls the cathedral.
Okay.
And the cathedral is the enemy. The cathedral is that which must be thwarted.
Yeah, actually, Markowitz touched on this in his book. I didn't mention it because it's a big and deep book. But he pointed out that
the university started to embrace diversity as a deflection to the accusation that they were just there to educate white male Christian students. And there developed at the same time the meritocratic winnowing, the competitive Hunger Games type education that became the current system. So the two are intertwined. He pointed out that there was a book written in 1962, I believe, called America's Poor or something like that. I didn't take the notes yet. I have read it, but I haven't taken the notes down, so I'm not sure about the name. But this was an examination of the very bottom strata of society that was usually not white. There were quite a few white people in the desperately poor category, but mostly it was the immigrant communities. And the reaction to this book was what changed very slowly and over decades the university acceptance of the non-white student, which has morphed in extreme into the SJW culture. And I think we've talked about it in the last little go-round with Sandel. I personally believe that because the very, very wealthy have prevented the university from teaching alternative economic systems, that all of the energies of criticism of the current system have gone into identity politics. And it's not the problem of the university necessarily. It's the way the university has been constricted to focus only on identity and not on economics. And Markowitz pointed out, it's like, imagine you go to university as a black person. Well, if you go in there as any student at all, they have programs at Harvard and Yale to help middle-class people adopt to the elite way of socializing, not of studying, of socializing. And he said, think about that for a minute. It's okay to make jokes about flyover states. It's okay to criticize crackers and rednecks and workers and people that drive big trucks and listen to country music. That's fine. But flip it around. What if you went to university as a black person and says, don't worry, we're going to teach the black right out of you. That's what they are doing to the middle class. That has become fair game. And that is what's sparking Mencius Moldbug's, part of what is sparking Mencius Moldbug's theory, is the condescension that the university puts on people like him, who are never going to get up to the upper echelons, but yet are being blamed for everything just because they resemble the upper echelons in skin tone. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that part of the book is like, yeah, motherfucking right. I mean, I grew up middle class myself. I am middle class. And yet I'm educated. You are educated. You are middle class. What the hell?
Yeah, middle class is, I mean, I've talked about this so many times. It's a very weird notion. Like, the house I'm living in now is a house that my grandfather built. He was a farmer. He spent his life as a farmer. Maybe he went to some high school. He certainly didn't graduate high school. But he and, you know, my grandmother had four kids. My grandmother has, I think, a fourth or fifth grade education. They sent all four of their kids to college. Mm-hmm. My father's parents were certainly working class. I mean, my father's mother, she was born in Ireland, came over to the United States by herself at the age of 16, married the son of Irish immigrants, and he worked hard industrial jobs in New York City, where he received grisly injuries on the job, you know, that he had to take months and months to recover from, and which, you know, certainly cost him a lot of quality of life in his retirement years. These are not middle-class people. And yet my mother and father, who both went to college at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, you know, they have a middle-class sensibility. And when I was raised middle-class, but, you know, it was a very, very thin foundation, you know, for my middle-class existence to rest on, one generation, you know. And now, in terms of income, I'm certainly not middle-class.
But that part has shifted, yes.
Yeah, I married a woman who also went to college, and we have two sons who are, you know, they have very different skill sets and, you know, intellectual and personality types. But, you know, they're well-spoken in a way, you know, so they don't really fit very easily into the working class, particularly my older son. But again, they don't have the economic side of a middle class existence. So what does middle class even mean? You know, it's, right. It's something that when I was growing up, it wasn't just descriptive, it was normative.
Yes.
You know, middle class was good. Mm-hmm. It was better than the classes below it, and in a way more real than the classes above it. Like, you know, there's something about the wealthy, and we didn't really have the notion of the technocracy or the profession, or the professional managerial class at the time. It was just poor working people, middle class, rich.
Yep.
We weren't rich, but we weren't below middle class. But, you know, no matter how far you fall in terms of your material existence and your income, that middle class self-identification, it sticks, you know, it's like tar. There's no getting rid of it. Or, you know, if you do get rid of it, it's like George W. Bush, who, when he was the governor of Texas, he talked like a normal person, you know, and he's the son of New England aristocracy.
Yes.
But that Texas drawl and that dumb guy persona, he cultivated that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and he probably not by himself either. He probably was coached in that extensively.
He mispronounced subliminally the exact same way every time. So he did not mispronounce subliminally. He said subliminality or whatever he says deliberately to fit in with people who hadn't been to Yale.
Yep. And I bet if you could find any video of him talking about nuclear weapons in high school, he would have said nuclear.
Exactly.
But as president, he said nuclear.
Yep.
You know,
he used that as a very effective weapon against Al Gore, who, well, you know, Al Gore is whip smart, sharp, and very well read, mm-hmm. but an idiot in many ways. And one of them, he never seemed to grasp the importance of his own presentation.
Yeah.
My God, that man was stupid when it came to his own presentation.
That transformation on the part of George W. Bush, though, probably didn't change his internal identification. It didn't change the way he thought about himself and where he belonged and who his people were. That was all for, you know, presentation purposes, and it worked.
Yeah.
But, you know, the one thing that I think Markowitz says, at least he said this in the interview with these two Dutch kids I just watched, the person who is aspiring, you know, and whose parents are helping them to aspire to, you know, be part of the professional managerial class and to get into the elite school and to get on the gravy train and do really well, they understand that they have a long way to fall. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if they do fail and they do fall down to the level of, you know, people who didn't go to college, they're not going to be comfortable. I mean, the people who never went to college, you know, who come from a working class background and that's how they identify, they may not have much money, but, you know, they're comfortable at that strata. And, you know, not to diminish anybody's psychological torture of living paycheck to paycheck or whatever, but, you know, somebody who falls from upper middle class existence down into the ranks of the working poor, that person is going to be in hell because they won't be able to relate to any of the people around them. At least not at first.
Won't be able to communicate with them.
Right. And yeah. You know, efforts to communicate with them will just mark them as an outsider and somebody who probably thinks that they're better. And, you know, in their heart of hearts, they probably do think that they're better than the people around them.
Exactly. The disdain for the working class comes from those people. You know, they won't be able to tell the jokes. It'd be like, you know, an avowed racist. Suddenly, oh, I have to live in this place? Well, all my jokes regard the people I'm surrounded with by.
Yeah.
No, absolutely.
That particular example, Southern racists are quite good at getting along with Black people.
Oh, I'm not talking about Southern racists.
Yeah.
I've met very few of those. I'm talking about some hardcore Northwest racists. We had the Klan here, too.
The most racist people I've ever encountered were Irish Americans in New York City.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, the Irish, you know, their cultural identity is when we came here, we were considered just as bad as the blacks. And, you know, we clawed ourselves up to second from the bottom. And now, you know, to really affirm our position as not being in the very bottom slot, we have to direct maximum hatred toward the people just below us.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a middle-class Irish, so I'm not sure I understand that.
There's a bar near where I used to live in Brooklyn, and they had, it was an Irish pub-style bar, and they had a sign on the wall that looked old and was probably, you know, there, not in that establishment necessarily, but, you know, was actually not ironic when it was made. It said, no dogs are Irish.
Yep. I've seen those in pictures from the 20s in the Gilded Age when they first came over. Yeah. Yeah. My folks are very similar to yours. I mean, my grandparents, my grandpa left home when he was 10. Long story there. Trained himself as a farm worker and a mechanic. Became a mechanic. Met grandma somewhere in North Dakota. She had no education. And, you know, my mom was magna cum laude of her college. They worked and put her through college. And back then, a working person could put their kid through college.
Right. Well, you could put yourself through college by working a part-time job.
Exactly. Yeah. Mom did a lot of college by, you know, what did she say? It's like part-time job during school, full-time job in the summer. She was able to pay for a private institution that's very well regarded academically. My dad, you know, his parents, I don't know. They fled the potato blight in 49 or something like that. But, you know, they eventually made it to the Washington's Peninsula up in Port Angeles by 54. So they're some of the first settlers up there that weren't native. And grandpa, when he came along, he was also a mechanic, but he also had land and he rented burros for people going up into the Olympic Mountains to do whatever they do. A lot of people were gold mining at that time. But, you know, he put his four boys, almost all of them, through college. Only my Uncle Len stopped doing that. He just went into a business with Dad. So he became a mechanic and construction. So, yeah, like everybody went to good colleges. And again, that very narrow window of opportunity to create our parents, the middle class, is gone. It is disappearing. And that's why people are pissed. And you World can blame, II, I like, think, was just also bug. You can that. Blame the universities. But you know what? I don't know. I have theories as to why, you know, the middle class started to exist and then disappeared. But, you know, they're only theories.
So we should probably be wrapping it up, but I just can't leave this topic without mentioning universal basic income.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I was a Yang Gang member in 2020. He was my guy, but I always liked Andrew Yang a whole lot more than I liked universal basic income. And that's even more true now. I mean, I don't see that as helpful, really. I mean, I think it's going to cement a lot of people into, you know, lifetime poverty.
I agree. And I think universal basic income attempts to do, in order to wrap the whole conversation together, attempts to do what meritocracy attempted to do. It attempts to deflect the act of socialism by saying it's not socialism, it's actually capitalism. Meritocracy attempted to deflect hard work of the criticism of the aristocracy not doing hard work by making sure the meritocrats work hard. So it's hard to complain about the people making their money when they work hard. It's hard to complain that universal basic income is socialism when people spend it on whatever they want.
Right.
It's a deflection tool. I mean, if you took the same money and created universal healthcare, universal pension, stuff that doesn't even touch the capitalist system, you would improve healthcare and pension, and you would get more value per dollar spent toward especially the lower end. You absolutely wouldn't get the same value if, you know, you give a billionaire $1,000 a month, who cares? You know, he probably wouldn't notice. But to get the most bang for the buck, we have to improve the social efficiency of our institutions as opposed to improving the profitability of the meritocratic jobs.
Say that again, and what does it mean?
Well, when we were talking earlier about how the meritocratic jobs improved the bottom line for the corporations that employed the meritocrats, the high frequency trading, the device that will put people out of work eventually, but will sell wildly in the meantime. These are not socially beneficial jobs. Now, not all meritocratic jobs are socially not beneficial. That is not what I'm saying. I'm saying a great many of them are trying to capitalize on a niche market that the technology can now do. So you have to throw technocrats to develop the technology to make the profit. If we instead directed the same energies toward solving the problems of society, like improving the cost of healthcare and, well, actually improving the value per dollar spent of healthcare, in line with what most of Europe and most of Asia has done, or what Japan has done, we will give people more money in their pockets because they won't be spending as much on healthcare. We direct people away from the expensive treatments because they're way too expensive and direct them towards stuff that is equally as good but costs a fraction. We improve their lives. The meritocratic system is directed at doing just the opposite. It's directed at profits. It's directed at making drugs so expensive that ordinary people can't afford them, but people with insurance and people with Medicare can. They are gouging the Medicare system. They're gouging the insurance system to make their profits. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And just by doing that, by redirecting our energies and our monies and our emphasis on what is valued, we can improve everyone's lives as much as, if not more, than a universal basic income.
This brings up many big topics that we can't explore in much detail. So, I mean, for me, largely, it's technology in general, and you know, a well-structured society will allow for people to exist with very little effort, really. I mean, this is came up in a conversation that I recorded yesterday or day before yesterday, but I put out yesterday. You know, if there is no real possibility of failure, then for a lot of people, there's no real incentive to raise a finger, you know, or if failure in quotes doesn't involve like some social humiliation and some actual genuine physical suffering. Well, you know, some people just won't bother. So it seems like in our current milieu, you know, in American capitalism, particularly for the Red Tribers, you know, with that mentality, they value the suffering of the losers. Like the suffering of the losers is not only just, but it's beneficial to society. We want people who don't try hard, we don't want them to be able to just kick back and live a small but comfortable life. We want them to suffer. And I don't want them to suffer. But at the same time, I don't want to take away the incentive for innovation or risk-taking or hard work.
Right.
So
There's a middle path there.
Right. If the people at the bottom aren't going to be humiliated and made to suffer, you know, dramatically in order to put the fear of God into everybody else, if we take that off the table, then we need to have some pretty fat rewards for the people who do make an effort. But the fat rewards have gotten way too fat.
Yes. Yes. And we have not removed from the table the fattest of rewards. That isn't even in people's perspective.
And we haven't sworn off the humiliation and the needless suffering of the losers.
We haven't given them an alternative to the needless suffering.
Yeah. But, you know, in some circles, that suffering is still valued as a good.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's the problem. What is defined as the good? I mean, okay, you're right. We can't get into that.
Yeah, it's big. That's big.
It's huge.
All right. Hey, Jim, thank you very much for this. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, KMO. Take it easy, man.
That was Jim, a regular voice here on the CROM Vault podcast, and somebody whom I have never heard a bad word spoken about. If you have a bad word to speak about Jim, I don't want to hear it. So do go listen to his podcast and come back here to the CROM Vault. I'll have more information and entertaining material for you quite soon. Stay well.